Hey friend, I just wanted to let you know before the space ran out that our fall metaphysics reading group is almost closed. The first meeting is October 24th, and we have four spots left. So if you wanted to join to read Ross Inman's new Introduction to Metaphysics, What is Reality, along with additional material guided by our philosophy director, Matt Natiros, make sure to sign up today. You can find out more information on our website. Go look at the reading groups on the resources tab. It'll take you right there and you can sign up. Again, there's just four spots left in just a couple of weeks before it begins. You're going to meet twice per month for five total meetings, 90 minutes each meeting. It's going to be really, really great. So if you've wanted to have a low-pressure opportunity to learn more about metaphysics, this is your shot. Now for the episode. On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Nate Aiken about his new book, Convictional Confessional Cheerful Baptist. So we cover all sorts of topics like, what is a convictional Baptist, a confessional Baptist, a cheerful Baptist? What are these distinctives? Are there really robust Baptist distinctives that all Baptists must have and that are necessary to their identity? How do we address some of the important topics of our day as Baptists, things like Christian nationalism, things like complementarianism? How do we navigate those with the proper sort of convictions while also being cheerful and kind in those approaches? And we talk some about the Pillar Network too and what Nate's up to with that. So we cover a lot of ground. It's a lot of fun. Give it a whole thing a listen. You're going to really enjoy it. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum, where a podcast is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And in thinking seriously, we've tried to encourage or cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. Things that go along really well with the guests I'm going to be interviewing today and the book that we're talking about. So this is a really nice match for us. So we've got Nate Aiken with us talking about his brand new book, Convictional Confessional Cheerful Baptist. And it's a wonderful little book that I think is the perfect size for local churches to be able to hand out to members and to hand out to different, you know, church leaders or whoever it may be and say, let's read this book together. I know a lot of people these days, they don't read even one book a year anymore. If you want to get your church people reading, you kind of have to meet them at their level sometimes. And I know part of the whole thing of our podcast is like, we don't want to drop the sort of standards, but this is a nice book because it engages all the important topics in a short span. So you're talking about 120 pages covering a significant number of important topics. So before we jump into talking about the content of the book, Nate, tell me a little bit about yourself and then what was it that sort of was the, say, you know, impetus to say, I want to write this book.
Thanks, Jordan. Appreciate being on, brother. And for the kind words there about the book. So Nate Aiken, I'm the executive director of the Pillar Network. So I've been working with Pillar now a little bit over 6 years. So, and I became the executive director almost 2 years ago. I've enjoyed that immensely. Have been in the past. I was a church planter, helped plant Imago Dei Church here in Raleigh, was with them from the beginning, one of the founding pastors, was there I was there almost 7 years, so spent a good bit of time there. I've always had a heart for church planting. When I had first come to seminary in 2007 and really started to develop convictions about ecclesiology, I just thought, man, starting a church and trying to put these ecclesiological principles in place from the beginning would be a really exciting thing to do. So I've been kind of had a heart for that, but also a heart for missiology. I mean, I grew up in a family that's been committed to sending people all over the world, and love thinking about missions. And so the intersection of missiology and ecclesiology, I think, is church planting. And so it's always been a heart and a passion for me. And so it's been great to do that, but then also to be now serving in this role and trying to help serve churches that are trying to do that. And I've been doing pastoral ministry stuff along the way as well. I kind of say as a side gig, but pastoral ministry is not really a side gig. So it's, I stay really busy, and thankful for that. Married, have two kids, have a four-year-old. So married to Kelsey, have a four-year-old named Ada. She's named after a British Baptist who was a contemporary of Spurgeon, a hymn writer. Many listeners might know He Will Hold Me Fast. And then we just had a little boy, he's 9 months old, who we named Ryland after John Ryland Jr., who was friends with Andrew Fuller and William Carey and helped with the Baptist Mission Society. And so being Baptist is in the blood. And so it, we've even kind of played that out in our family. The book itself, so it came out of a talk I did at our main conference, our Pillar Unite conference we have every year. I did it last year. And we can talk more about this, and it's the title of the book, but basically we were doing our DNA point of being confessionally Baptist. And one of the things I really wanted to impress upon, and as I had become kind of I'd been a year into my role at Pillar. And one of the things I really wanted to impress upon our people, because we were settled, you know, we're pretty settled in our convictions. We're a Reformed Baptist network. But you know, we live in a time where, there's kind of like squishiness on the one side and people just sort of are more malleable with their convictions, and thinking in an Ephesians 4 world, they're kind of tossed by the wind. And then there's another group of people who are very committed to their convictions, but they also just have a posture about them that is not, let's say it like this. I want Pillar to keep both the right convictions and the right culture. Like if you come to a Pillar event, typically it's a pretty happy, sort of humble, kind of nitty gritty type work. And my desire for the network is not just to keep the right convictions, but to keep the right culture with those convictions. And I think that sort of springs out of this idea that we're saved by justification through faith. We're saved by God's electing purposes, and it's all by His grace that we're saved. And that shouldn't just impact how we think about our own salvation. It should impact how we think about the convictions that we've formed. It should impact the way by which we hold those convictions. And so that was really sort of, you see the ditches all around, and you have this ditch of kind of squishiness, and then you have this ditch of kind of anger, haughtiness, and pride. And what I was hoping to just kind of cast before our people is just a kind of encouragement. Hey, let's stay the course with our convictions, and let's stay the course with our culture. And that was really what kind of led me to that. And then a guy came to me and said, hey, let's turn this into a book. And I was for that. And so that's kind of what led to the book, if you will.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the Pillar Network eventually at the end. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in that, if you're listening, stay for the end to make sure we talk about that. But I am curious. So there's been obviously a lot of polarization over the last decade plus. In what sense can you really be convictional and confessional and still be cheerful, without going a third way ism? Because that seems to be the greatest, right? Like let's beat up the third way approach. Yeah. Is this a third way, or is this distinct from that?
Well, I mean, you want to hesitate to say that because sometimes you just get kind of that gets written off. And I even say this in the book, like in one sense, I guess you could say this is a third way. Cause I think there is a ditch between just people who are compromising their convictions. And there is a ditch of like, man, people just like there's so many people that think with some of these guys that you're like, man, I think I agree with most everything they say. I have no idea. I have no desire to be connected to that sort of thing. And so in that sense, it is a third way. Now I get into the book, and there are issues that are not third way issues. And so, and I try to hit on particularly like complementarianism, for instance. I don't really think there's a third way in that, but there is a way. I think there is a way to be firmly complementarian and not be a jerk. And so if that is considered a third way, then maybe that's what I'm saying in the book. But I'm, in one sense, I'm trying to navigate between the trying to say it's a third way. I'm trying to say you don't have to compromise on what you say at all. And I think sometimes the third way is compromising on sort of what you say, but you do need to think through how you say certain things. And so in some sense, maybe guilty as charged, if that's how people are using the term third way. In another sense, I'm not really talking about the issues as much as the posture that comes with those issues. And so I think there's a way to do that without being like this sort of, you know, in the middle, spit them out of my mouth, sort of lukewarm kind of thing about the topics, if that makes sense.
So in your experience, what's been most helpful at developing sort of the cultural mindset to say like, we can actually be kind as we hold to these doctrinal convictions?
So for me, what really struck me, so I when I was starting to work on the talk, I didn't know what was going to take shape fully. I was just studying a lot about confessions, just studying a lot about other things. But what struck me was even my own conviction. So the fact that I'm Reformed, the fact that I'm thoroughly committed to being a Baptist, I started to think through that is also an evidence of God's grace. So certainly my election was God's work. But the things that I've come to believe, and the thing that kept coming to me in my mind is like, you have nothing that you have not received. Like I didn't come up with these convictions. For whatever reason, I was born into the family I was born into. I went to the seminary that I went to. Certain books in seminary and certain books in the local church that I was studying to be a pastor in gripped my heart more than others. And really it was a kind of even those books, because I felt like they were the most representative of, hey, here's how we best understand the scriptures. And so even that, like I didn't always, you know, there's some choice, if you will, in what professors you pick. But the Lord's like even allowing me to be born into a family or to have the means to do the certain things that I could do to start developing the convictions, like the Lord orchestrated and directed that. So how can I be arrogant in what I believe if I received those things? It was a gift that the Lord, I mean, the Old Testament imagery of like, I'm drinking deeply from cisterns I did not dig, kept coming to mind. And then really that is a aspect of salvation, right? Like this is unmerited. And so if we've been saved by grace, and I say this often, and I'm sure I didn't come up with it, but I say this in that sermon and in the book, it's really a shame that those who say they love the doctrines of grace aren't gracious people. And I just think cultivating we should hold to our convictions in the same way we came to know them in the first place, and that was by grace. And so that was the main, I even kind of ended the sermon really highlighting that kind of aspect. We have nothing that we have not received. So how in the world can we not be happy that the Lord has shown his affection to us in a way that was undeserved? And so, yeah, that was really the sort of way I'm trying to help my own. Because so in one sense, I'm preaching to myself. I'm a very convictional person, which leads me to think that people who don't agree with me on certain topics are not as enlightened as I am. They're not, you know, obviously they're not as sharp as I am. And so I think that's prideful. I think that's arrogant. I think it's sinful. And so I was really speaking to myself and hopeful that that would also be encouraging to other people.
Yeah. You've got two whole chapters on Baptist confessions in this book. And if anybody's a regular listener of Baptist 21, I know last year, I think it was, maybe it was this year, sometime in the last 6 to 12 months, you had several people on talking about Baptist confessions. What would you say is the most important aspect from those chapters that you really wanted to drive home to people who are reading the book?
So I think there's a lot of misconceptions about Baptists and confessions because, you know, there's this mantra, no creed but the Bible. Like there's this misunderstanding because, I don't think we've done a good job teaching Baptist distinctives, which is another reason I wrote the book, but also I don't think we've done a good job of saying like, here's who we've been historically. And so this whole idea that Baptists are not confessional people, like, cause that's a Presbyterian thing or, you know, there's no creed but the Bible, is just a misunderstanding. And so the primary thing, particularly with all the stuff that was going on in the SBC at the time, and just kind of how is the confession going to function in our cooperation? I just wanted to say, hey, look, because this works in Baptist circles who have our own level of traditionalism. It's like, no, this is deeply rooted in who we are. Like, so anybody that's saying to you, we're not confessional does not have an accurate handling of the history of who we are. I mean, in fact, Timothy George, which is a book we gave out at our conference last year, in his book on confessions, quotes guys like Andrew Fuller and even E.Y. Mullins and others in saying like, they even use terms like Baptist creed and just saying it's anybody who's saying we're not a confessional people. Timothy George is saying that's not an accurate reflection of who Baptists have historically been. So I think that's incredibly important. And there's a reason why it's important. And I think it's increasingly important getting through postmodernism and other things where truth is relative, where people now have fanciful interpretations of the Bible. They say they believe the Bible, but they could basically come up with whatever they want the Bible to say. That's where confessions are massively helpful to us because they help us to see like, hey, well, previous generations thought this was an obvious issue from the scriptures, and now you're saying something completely different. And I think that helps us see when something new, novel comes along, it helps us to have a kind of a history to look back on and say, no, our brothers and sisters throughout the history of what we've been trying to do don't agree with you on this. They don't see this as a, and it, that doesn't kill conversation, right? I mean, we had the Protestant Reformation, but it does help us in a culture that kind of meaning is up to the person reading the text. It helps us stay rooted and grounded. And I think our people need to understand confessions are not, we have been this historically, and they're not less important now. They're actually, in some sense, they're more important now, given how meaning and truth and all these things are up for grabs. I think they're as important now as they've ever been. And so one of the things I want to say is it's not a bad thing to be confessional. It's not a bad thing at all. It's actually a very, very helpful thing. And there's a reason why our brothers and sisters have thought it was important in their cooperative work from the 1600s on.
Mm-hmm. So what about the people who look at confessions and say, I like confessions, that sounds good, but I don't want to take the whole package of everything that's included there. Even the Baptist Faith and Message, I like a lot of what's going on there, but my church practices open communion or whatever else that may be out of step. And you'd say, well, I'm within at least the general spirit of it. So yeah. In what sense would you encourage them? Would you say that's an appropriate way to use the confession, or should they be more like, let's be all or nothing? Or do we need to have a conversation about revising something?
Are you asking that as far as cooperation together in the SBC? Are you asking that as far as the local church or sort of?
I'm just thinking, let's just take any association that says, mm-hmm. We have a statement of faith, whatever it may be, and how should that document be used?
Yeah. Well, and I know that even in kind of some Presbyterian circles, there's differing levels of subscription, and I'm not thoroughly against that, but one of my concerns is, and it's been in this whole conversation, boundaries are a good thing. So anytime you provide really wise, helpful boundaries to your cooperation or to anything really, that's actually more of a sign of love than a sign of not being loving, because it's saying, hey, no, here's clearly who we are. And if you think this is a good place to be, come on in, let's do this and let's do it together. Let's know where we stand. The way I probably say it like this, I don't think malleable subscription is a long-term solution to cooperation. I just don't. I think that the issues that we're dealing with in the SBC, we will continue to deal with, if we have sort of a, you can kind of take or leave much of what, and I actually think to be fair. So as I say that, I actually think we've become more and more without realizing it, we've become more and more confessional, than we were. So it's a fair statement for some to say, this is not historically how we've been. And I'm thinking sort of again, you can cherry pick pieces of history to make your point, which I readily admit. So since I readily admit that, I get it. If you're saying, hey, it's not always been like this. Yeah, 100%. I get that. That doesn't mean that's always been best. In fact, in all my studying of the confessions, the thing that struck me was 1925, 1963, 2000, all the different versions of the Baptist Faith and Message. The thing that led us to those moments was not having a confession. And what perpetuated the issues that kept going from 25 to 63 to 2000 were that we weren't asking people to subscribe to the BFNM. And so we weren't making a clear statement about who we were. And so it led to some of the issues that caused the rift and divisions and caused the need for the conservative resurgence. And so I'm just saying I'm fine with it being a broad confession if we feel like we're a broad tent. Right. I think I'm fine with that. Pillar is going to be a little different because we're going to be a little more strict, but I see benefit to being in a broader tent. But I don't think that tent should be, you should know where the end of that tent starts. I actually think the Baptist Faith and Message is pretty broad. I don't think it's a very strict confession. I think that's one of the beauties of it. It was very interesting too, because I said this on the Nine Marks panel at the SBC, I had been studying these confessions. One of the things that I looked at was the Peace Committee in the mid 80s, when all the stuff was happening, conservative resurgence. You had you know, to use the clear terms, conservative and liberal, and they were all together on a different committee, and they're studying all the institutions and seeing how, you know, what's happened. Are they out of step with who we are as Baptists? Are they out of step with inerrancy, so forth? And one of the things that was interesting in this peace committee was that they knew that they needed a standard of faith. So they, at that point, the 1963, and they needed that to mean something for the cooperation for the entities of the SBC. And so they started using language even in the in their recommendations of affirming of the BFNM. And yet it still took till after the 2000 to actually make our institutions do it. So again, I don't think that was good or best. I think it led to the further issues, but I also think there is a move towards being more confessional. And as I've said, sort of alluded to already, in the world in which we live, where meaning is up to the person, then we have to have confessions. We have to be able to say, this is what we believe, this is where we stand. And if you're with us, let's be all in. Because if not, we're going to have debates and arguments every year at the SBC over different topics. I mean, just years ago, I'll just tell a story real quick. So years ago, and if I said this person's name, probably many of the listeners would know who I'm talking about. And this was, he's now openly homosexual, like is very clear about that. He was not when we had this conversation, and it was at an SBC. And he said, you know, I don't understand why y'all keep talking about, it feels like all we do is talk about homosexuality. And it's that typical assertion about us. It's like, you guys care so much about this and you don't care about all these other issues. And I said that that's not true. I said, here's the problem. And you won't see it like this, but here's the problem, because everybody's casting this as an issue of love and not of sin. But I said, if we had a ton of Southern Baptists regularly saying you can be a Christian and just steal occasionally, we would have to talk about stealing a lot, because we would have to confront the whatever the sin of the age was and be very clear about it. Well, the confessions help us do that. Like, the confessions help us say, look, no, like that's never been something that we've said is okay. And so if you're going to keep talking about this as being consistent with a Christian witness and consistent with what the scriptures say, then we have to address it. And the confessions are a way for us to do that and to provide those boundaries when the world does get topsy-turvy. And that's what's happened. Again, I don't think they went far enough as far as subscription, but that's happened with every iteration of the BFNM. Every iteration was confronting some sort of issue of the day that was starting to threaten the fellowship of the churches and the doctrine of the churches. And so, yeah, I'm fine to have good conversation about, you know, subscription. I think it is, but I don't know in a world like ours how we get away from moving in that direction and still keeping any semblance of a kind of codified doctrine that we hold to. And so I don't see the negative of that. I actually see the positive of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, you have several chapters on Baptist distinctives, and I'd love for you to give an explanation for what you think a Baptist distinctive is. Is this something that's unique to only Baptists, or is this something that just marks out a bunch of Baptists, and maybe if you don't have that distinctive, you can still be Baptist or not?
So I think what makes you Baptist is that you hold these all together. So I think there are distinctives in that are, and again, I mean, I make this joke at the beginning of the chapter, and it's so true. Like, there's not even universal agreement on this. And the joke is, you know, put two Baptists in a room, get three opinions. I mean, that's true. But what I did is sort of like come up with the most basic ones that we hold to. And what I think makes you Baptist is holding these together for the reasons you hold them together. So there are plenty of denominations and groups that hold to, you know, people, there are people of the book, there are plenty that hold to immersion. But what makes us unique is you holding these together for the reasons you do. And I do think that's why guys like Hammett and others have been helpful in their books to say what really was at the beginning of this was not believers' baptism by immersion. I part of what I think in our churches is that most people think what it means to be a Baptist is you just immerse, you know, you immerse believers, and that's what it means to be a Baptist. There's so much more going on than you just immerse people and then cooperate to do missions together. Hammett says in his book, the Baptist mark of the church is regenerate church membership. And what led to the breaking with the Pado Baptists was, no, we actually think that it needs to be a believer's church, that those who are in the church are those who are actually Christians. And so that led to, well, then also that fits with the mark of you only immerse somebody who has what the word means, and we could go into more of that, but you only put the sign on the person who's actually, you believe, is credibly part of the covenant community. And then that leads to congregationalism and autonomy. We're not a hierarchical structure. We believe that the keys of the kingdom have been given to the local congregations. And because they are believers indwelt by the Spirit, they can be active participants in the work of the church. And then that leads to religious liberty. We don't think that, and actually it's not even just religious liberty, it's liberty of conscience. So that gets into several different issues, but we, you know, that's the sole competency and priesthood of the believers and religious liberty. We don't think that one, anybody can gain salvation for you. So you're not like born into being a Christian, that you have to have repentance and faith to be regenerated, but you had to be regenerated to have repentance and faith. But we also then don't think the government can coerce you, or any outside civil organization can coerce you into that salvation. So it's like, so the simple way to say it is your parents can't gain salvation for you, neither can your country. And that all holds together. And so one of the things that was a real impetus was I think that these are the most accurate reflection of the New Testament. I think Baptist theology is, I think it's is the best one that I've seen when I've gone back to the scriptures and studied. But I don't think enough Baptists know why they're Baptists. And so I really, it's a short thing. I mean, like, if you've studied Baptist distinctives, it is not, there's nothing groundbreaking in there, but it is just a very kind of primer on here's what it means to be Baptist. I even try to address practical issues for current day topics on those different issues. And, but I'm just trying to give a little short, hey, this is what it means to hold these together, if that makes sense. So I hope people could read it and become more convinced of why it's important to hold these things together.
Now, tell me, you have chapter 7, locally autonomous and elder-led congregationalism. I mean, how many of our Baptist churches are deacon-led congregationalism committee-led congregationalism? Are they not Baptists?
Yeah, I mean, they're Baptists. There's a version of like where you can be the best Baptist and you can be floating towards being being the best Baptist. I mean, none of us are going to ever be perfect in our polity, and we're all going to be striving for that. But So one of the things that has been really helpful in, I think, the conservative resurgence and the recapturing of the Bible is to move towards things that seem very obvious in the scriptures, like plurality of male qualified elders. But then you'll have people say, because for nearly a century, that's not how Baptists have operated, or at least most Baptists have operated. And it's, what's helpful is no. Some of the old Baptists got this right. Some of the old confessions got this right. Again, back to the importance of confessions. And so you can say to people, hey, no, this is actually very Baptist. It just has been lost over time, and we're regaining it, recapturing it. I think they're Baptist. I just think they're, so we talk about, are Presbyterians a true church? You say, yeah, you know, we think they're a true church. They're a disordered church. I would say they're disordered Baptists going, hopefully moving towards being more ordered Baptists, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. Now, what I liked about the book in particular is you have a second part and you have a couple of case studies here. One of them being on Christian nationalism and the other one being on complementarianism. Talk to me about how do we hold, what's Christian nationalism, depending on who you talk to, obviously is going to be something different. So maybe walk me through what you mean by that, and if you can truly be a Baptist while holding to whatever it is that we're going to define it as, and then talk to me about the office of pastor. Is there any wiggle room? I mean, should we, is it okay to give someone the title of pastor, but say, well, no, they're not doing what you call an elder. They're just doing, administrative tasks.
Yeah. And if I don't answer any of those questions, like if I miss any in my answer, just feel free to throw them back. Yeah. I mean, again, those two issues are just, really hot issues right now. And I thought, hey, I thought it'd be a helpful exercise. Apply what I've been trying to say to two hot topics. And really, with the Christian nationalism thing, and I basically just used kind of a shorthand of Stephen Wolfe's argument in his book for what Christian nationalism is. Because like, again, there's people who will say like, oh, if you use biblical principles to vote, like you're a Christian nationalist. And I mean, that's insane. Like, I hope you're using biblical principles to vote. And that doesn't make, because a lot of people who get accused of being Christian nationalists are just Christians who, want to have Christian ideals. it's more the kind of have every elected official affirming the Nicene Creed and all these sort of things. Like, so you can see the definition in the book. That's more of what I was, and my issue with Christian nationalism again was twofold, well, really threefold. You know, number one, and with the argument of the book is what I mean. I don't think everything that the Christian nationalist folks are saying is wrong. I don't think some of their concerns are unwarranted. In fact, I do think there's a, again, the left seems to get a pass. Like, you know, President Trump speaks at First Baptist Dallas and the world goes crazy and says this is Christian nationalism. The mayor of Chicago speaks at Charlie Date's church and there's not a word for most. And so like, that's inconsistent. Let's hold this consistently. But my concern with the kind of strident CN crowd is number one, they are the kind of definition of like, if you don't agree with me, you're just like, you're one, you're a compromiser, two, you're weak, you're a loser. I mean, they use terms like you're a loser, the language they use gets to the whole posture that I'm trying to talk about in the book. Like that is so unhelpful. And so that's one thing. Like that, so they're to dare to use this word, their tone is it's not in keeping with what I think the Bible clearly says about us, about our speech, about the, you know, how is it to correct opponents with gentleness, like all those sort of things. Okay. Which I know I'll get made fun of for saying that maybe, but who cares? Like the Bible seems clear on some of these things. The other one is Baptists historically have been committed to religious liberty and to use his terminology, Christianizing the government, to somehow, by the way you order the government, binding somebody's conscience. And so one of the things that is striking to me was none of the confessions are seeing the mission of the church in the way the Christian nationalists are proposing it. So that's a problem. So that gets to the heart of the book. The other thing is, like, nowhere in the Bible, they'll use the Great Commission as an example of defending their view of mission, but like nowhere in the Bible, in Acts, there's nowhere where Paul is like telling the Jewish Christians how to take over the Sanhedrin. There's nowhere in Acts where he's telling these people in these major cities, like, here's how you take over the government. Nowhere in, you know, in Corinth, like in First and Second Corinthians, he's not saying to do it. Romans, he's not telling people how to do that. So it's shockingly absent from the scriptures. And again, because it's shockingly absent, it's not reflected in our confessions. And then another thing I asked some guys, because the beauty now of the Pillar Network is that we're in 30-something countries. So I started asking guys in other countries, is this even a conversation in the countries you're living in? And they're like, no, this is not a conversation at all. And I'm thinking, okay, if different centuries and different contexts don't think this is obvious, should it be obvious to us? And so that was one of my concerns with and then just the misplaced weight of the conversation. There's times when you read on social media, and the way I say it is, you know, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks, but out of the abundance of the heart, the fingers tweet. And there's just times when it's like, it seems to me some of this in the kind of more strident crowd of that's all they care about is politics. There's very little about disciple making, gospel, church, Bible. It's very driven by the kind of a political flair. And I'm thinking, again, I don't think those issues are unimportant. In fact, I have my own convictions. I have strong convictions on some of these things. But it just is striking to me that temporary matters matter more than eternal matters. And the Bible speaks a lot about that. And so, though I don't think these things are unimportant, I think there's misplaced emphasis, which then reveals something about what's going on in the heart, I think. On the complementarian stuff, again, it was the same thing. I had done a paper last summer. It was for a PhD class, just because all the stuff that's going on in the SBC, people saying you can be a pastor, not an elder. And I just thought, okay, you know, it would be an interesting exercise. How far back does this argument go? And so I started reading, like, the guys that make Sam Storms, Rick Warren, reading all their footnotes, trying to find out who makes this argument. The farthest back I could find was 2002, and a guy named Harold Honer, who was a professor at DTS, makes this argument in his Ephesians commentary that, you know, basically it's the first time. It's funny because he had a 1984 commentary where he didn't make this argument on Ephesians, but he had a 2002 one where he did, and then a 2007 article where he made it more explicit. It was just an article, and I think it was in Jets, that was like, is it permissible for a woman to be a pastor? And so then I started reading all the footnotes in both, and I couldn't get further back than him. Now, there's guys who would say, who would imply that that pastor is a gift in an office, which seems obvious. But there's nobody that would say, even the liberals who were making a egalitarian argument, were not dividing it up. You know, they weren't trying to make, and so it was just a, hey, this is, they're trying to have their egalitarian cake and eat it too sort of thing, but say they're complementarian. And the way I kind of, the warning to me was, you know, 6 years ago, what it meant to be complementarian was, you know, women can't be pastors or elders and they can't preach to the gathered congregation. Then it became, well, they can occasionally preach to the gathered congregation. Then it became, well, they can be pastors, but not elders. And then eventually for some, like Rick Warren, went all the way. And I just thought, okay, I know the confessions the confessions will help us on this. And it wasn't even just Baptist confessions. Are there any confessions that say pastor is a gift and not an office? None. You cannot find one in any denomination. You can find denomination confessions that don't address it, that don't address the offices, but you cannot find one. And I just thought, well, that should be telling to us. And so can somebody call a person a pastor who's not functioning in the office of pastor? I guess they can. I think that's incredibly unwise. I think that it doesn't really mean that they're, you know, qualified to do that, but somebody can call them, give them that title. But I think it's unwise. I think it's unwise to ever play fast and loose with terminology the Bible doesn't play fast and loose with, because I think it ends up teaching people, it can end up building mistrust when somebody actually does the research on their own. And I just don't think it's ever good to be sloppy with our terms. We wouldn't want to do that with anything else. So why, you know, why on this one? And if we're doing it on this one, that betrays, like, is there something else going on? And that was part of my issue with the whole Harold Honer thing. It's like, well, why are you trying to make this argument? Is it because of the way the culture's changing? And I think the answer to that is yes. And that's why, again, confessions help us to not change when the culture's changing. And so, yeah, I mean, again, you can give somebody a title. I can't, I'm a Baptist. I can't take that away from you. It would not be consistent with what the Bible is doing with those titles at all. And yeah. And it wouldn't be consistent to how our brothers and sisters have seen those titles throughout history.
Now, I'm curious, last question on this. You know, you mentioned how you've got Pillar Network and 30 plus countries. Have you asked also them, are they dealing with a similar question as this in other countries?
So one of the things that was striking to me was right before the SBC, and it's one of the things that sort of pushed me fully. I was already had voted for the law amendment the year before, but and was planning to, but what really just solidified it for me was all the Baptist unions in Europe have all gone this route. They've all, they've gone to the point of, like, you know, obviously females can be pastors. And so that was really telling to me, like, we need to make a statement here. We need to make a stand, because when you start to loosen up on these things, it actually leads to far. I mean, most are now affirming of gay affirming and other things, and so liberal, and their work is dead. I mean, I was on a conversation with some of our brothers in Scotland yesterday, and they were so one of our first international church with Pillar was in Edinburgh, Scotland. It's a good sized church, particularly for that European context. They have a ministry training program. They have six guys in that training program. They have more in there than the Baptist College of Scotland has. Zero guys in that school training for ministry, zero. And right now circulating resumes among the Baptist Union for opening pastor positions is zero. So right now there are more in that local church being trained for ministry than in all the other places combined. And that's a travesty. And that's what happens when you don't stay moored and anchored to what the scriptures are teaching through things like confessions. And that could be traced all the way back to stuff that happened with Spurgeon and so forth. But yeah, so we have these conversations in every country they're dealing with this. That's what's been refreshing to many of them about Pillars. Like, we don't really have any denomination here, and we're not a denomination, but we don't have any group here that is holding firm on these issues. We're looked at as weird, obviously bigoted, all those sort of things. But yeah, it's not just an American issue that's being dealt with. It's being dealt with all over the world.
Yeah. So if people want to learn more about the Pillar Network, where do they go for that?
So thepillarnetwork.com, that is where they can find out information about who we are. It's now close to, it's a little bit over 15 years old, but it was a little bit different in the early days, but really in the kind of the form we're in now, about 12 years old. Reformed Baptist Network in the States, we're all of our churches are connected to the SBC, happily so. Sort of describe us as we're a smaller huddle inside the big tent of the BFNM 2000. So we're going to, our confession and our DNA are going to be a little tighter than what's in the BFNM 2000. But then we also have Baptist churches that would fit those, that doctrine and DNA in now 30 plus countries. The Lord's blessing the work. The main thing I would say is, if you want a place where it's kind of the main thing that holds us together is doctrine, but then the main thing that keeps us together is mission. And that particularly for us, again, we believe that the local church is the means and end of missions. And so for us, the accomplishing of the Great Commission happens through the starting and strengthening of churches, local churches. That's who we are. That's kind of what we want to be about. And so if you have any interest in that, yeah, we'd love to talk with you more.
Awesome. Well, Nate, this has been great. I appreciate you taking the time. As a reminder, everybody,
thanks so much.
Get a copy of the book. I'll have a link in the show notes so you can go pick up a copy or pick up 10 or 20 or whatever it is that you hand them out at your church, you know, after an evening service or whatever. Or if you don't have an evening service, go ahead and start an evening service and start handing them out. And that would be a nice, useful tool for your church members. So, Nate, thanks. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, brother. Thanks so much.
Everybody who's been listening, thanks for tuning into the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.